Today is Monday, May 18, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 31 to 34 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's largest drone offensive of the war, with 556 drones shot down in a single night, along with the limited outcomes of the Trump-Xi summit in Beijing and the European Union's sweeping effort to rewire its trade relationships away from both China and American tariff pressure. Let's begin in the skies over Russia. Ukraine launched what Dr. Jason Smart, the Kyiv Post's military correspondent and national security advisor, described as the single largest drone assault conducted inside Russia during the entire course of the war. This operation surpassed in scale a prior campaign referred to as Operation Spiderweb, which had previously held the record. According to Smart, 556 Ukrainian drones were shot down by Russian air defenses between approximately 10 in the evening and 7 the following morning local time. And that number, 556, represents only the drones that were intercepted. Additional drones penetrated Russian airspace and reached their targets. Russia declared a national emergency across the country in response. The geographic footprint of the assault was staggering. Smart reported that the total area struck exceeded 282,000 square kilometers, roughly 110,000 square miles. Put that in terms American listeners will immediately recognize. That is larger than the entire state of Texas. This was not a targeted strike on a single facility. This was a distributed campaign across an enormous swath of Russian territory, designed to overwhelm defensive capacity. Moscow bore particular attention during the operation. The city's mayor initially reported at least 73 drones shot down over the capital. Smart noted that figure was subsequently revised upward to as many as 120 over a 24-hour period. Two of Moscow's major airports, Sheremetyevo and Vnukovo, were both closed, causing hundreds of flight cancellations. A Moscow-area oil refinery was struck, as was a fuel storage facility identified as Dvorichna. Target Smart specifically noted Ukraine had previously attempted to hit on multiple occasions without success. These were not targets of opportunity. They were persistent objectives that Ukrainian planners had been working toward. In Zelenograd, a technology-focused district outside Moscow, a facility described by Smart as producing microelectronics used in the conflict, was reported burning. Smart characterized this as compounding Russia's pre-existing microelectronics shortage, a supply chain vulnerability that appears repeatedly across the briefing's reporting. Further south, multiple air bases in Crimea, including Belbek, were struck. Sevastopol experienced sustained drone activity, and power was lost to large parts of the city. Strikes were additionally reported in Bryansk, Krasnodar, Rostov, Taganrog, Arabat, and Melitopol, targeting airfields, staging sites, and power infrastructure. Smart attributes the operation's penetration of heavily defended targets to a deliberate saturation strategy. As many as 24 drones were directed against the Moscow-area oil facility alone, enough simultaneous incoming threats to exhaust local point defenses. An organization Smart identified as the TASH, previously associated with sabotage of Russian rail infrastructure, was said to have participated through electronic warfare measures that degraded Russian air defense response capability during the assault. Smart provided no independent corroboration for that specific claim, and it should be treated as a single-source assertion. Building on Smart's account, it is worth cross-referencing with the analysis of Scott Lucas, professor of international politics at University College Dublin's Clinton Institute, to understand what is happening simultaneously in the other direction. Lucas stated that Russia launched nearly 1,500 drones and dozens of missiles against Ukraine within a single 24-hour period, a figure Lucas said was approaching 1,600 drones at the time of his remarks. Lucas reported at least 14 civilians killed on one day, and at least 8 more killed on the broadcast day, with 40 additional people injured. Irish journalist Killen Robertson, reporting separately for Channel 24 from Venice, corroborated the scale of Russian strikes around the May 9th Victory Day parade, describing Russia launching approximately 1,500 drones at Ukraine within 24 hours surrounding that date, destroying residential buildings and hospitals in Kyiv. The bidirectional nature of this escalation matters enormously for how we understand the war's current phase. Both sides are demonstrating industrial-scale drone production and deployment. Russia retains, in Lucas's assessment, sufficient drone and missile capacity to continue striking civilian infrastructure. But here is the strategic paradox. Despite that firepower, Lucas also noted that Russian ground forces have made almost no gains on the front line over the past 2 months. Current offensive efforts in Donetsk are producing only very limited advances and are falling well short of a breakthrough. The drone campaigns, for both sides, are increasingly substituting for stalled territorial progress, a war of long-range attrition layered over a largely frozen front line. Now the most striking internal Russian voice on the war's trajectory. Igor Girkin, also known by his nom de guerre Igor Strelkov, is the former FSB colonel who described himself as the trigger of the 2014 Donbas War. He is currently serving a 4-year prison sentence in Russia for extremism. According to sourced reporting from the military show, on April 25, 2026, Girkin's wife Miroslava Reginskaya relayed a Telegram post in which he stated directly, and this is a quote, "Unfortunately, we are heading for military defeat. That's a fact." Girkin cited a specific policy development as his concrete indicator, the European Council's approval of a 90 billion euro loan to Ukraine. He wrote, "The Council of Europe approved 90 billion for Ukraine." According to the military show's account, 45 billion euros of that total has already been made available to Ukraine in 2026. That breaks down as 8.35 billion in macro financial assistance, another 8.35 billion for the Ukraine facility, and 28.3 billion specifically earmarked to support Ukraine's defense industry. The loan was initially agreed in December 2025. Its passage was enabled by a critical political change, the April 12, 2026 electoral defeat of Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's Fidesz party by the Tisza opposition, led by incoming Prime Minister Peter Magyar. Magyar stated he would not interfere with the loan's disbursement, removing what had been the primary veto point blocking the package. Girkin's broader strategic analysis is worth unpacking carefully, because it comes from someone with deep institutional knowledge of Russian military and intelligence culture. He observed that Russia continues to supply Europe with gas at prices cheaper than American alternatives, and that European revenues from that gas are being reinvested in drone and missile production for Ukraine. He described this as a structural Russian strategic failure. Russia is essentially funding the military capacity being used against it. On mobilization, Girkin wrote on April 27 that, and again this is a direct quote relayed through his wife's Telegram post, "Mobilization was needed in the spring of 2022, spring of 2023, spring of 2024, and perhaps even spring of 2025. Now, mobilization is catastrophically late. He argued that Ukrainian drone warfare dominance means mass infantry mobilization can no longer reverse the outcome. His conclusion was blunt. Right now, you can mobilize as many people as you want to the front, but they won't be able to turn the tide of the war. That moment has passed." These assessments are reinforced by independent analytical commentary. Adrian Karatnitsky, a political analyst speaking to the 24 War and Politics channel, stated that Russia is making no progress on the battlefield and may actually be losing territory in some areas. He cited an economic picture that has deteriorated sharply. Russian economic growth has turned to negative 2% following a prior year in which it barely reached 1%. Russian consumer spending resources for ordinary people are projected to decline by between 10 and 15% in the current year. And Karatnitsky also cited a brain drain of as many as 1 million technically adept Russians who have left the country, a loss he described as being felt particularly acutely by the Russian elite. More importantly, the Institute for the Study of War, cited by the 24 War and Politics channel via Ukraine's Ministry of Defense, reported that Russia's cruise missile intercept rate has reached approximately 88% since January of the current year. Combined with Gierkin's mobilization analysis, the picture that emerges is of a military whose strategic coercion tools are being progressively degraded, both on the ground and in the air, even as it continues to inflict severe damage on Ukrainian civilians. A detailed operational portrait of how Western-supplied hardware is being adapted under combat pressure emerged from the military show's reporting on the M777-155mm howitzer, one of the most widely deployed Western artillery systems in Ukraine. The M777 was designed by BAE Systems with approximately 70% of its components manufactured in the United States. It weighs 4.2 tons, 41% lighter than the 7.15 ton M198 it replaced, owing primarily to titanium construction. Ukraine received an initial 90 systems from the United States in April 2022, with additional units from Canada and Australia. The first separate assault regiment confirmed receipt of a further consignment as of the time of reporting. What has happened to this system in 3 years of combat is a story about adaptation under pressure. Initially deployed near front lines for sustained fire missions, the role it was designed for, Ukrainian crews were forced to fundamentally rethink how the howitzer is used. They shifted to what is described as scoot-and-shoot tactics, multiple repositioning events within a single day in response to Russian UAV saturation. The threats are specific: Shahed drones, Lancet loitering munitions, and reconnaissance UAVs. The first separate assault regiment acknowledged directly that reaching a firing position is, in their words, largely a lottery, because detection risk during movement is so high. A particularly significant adaptation involves the system's own electronics. Crews have been removing onboard electronic components, tablets, batteries, GPS sensors, after discovering that Russia was exploiting electronic signatures to locate and target howitzers. The solution was to revert to manual operation, accepting the increased physical burden of using manual rammers. The system became less convenient in order to become less visible. But perhaps the most striking development in the M777 story is what Ukrainian engineers have built to protect the real systems, decoys. Ukrainian crews constructed replica M777 howitzers from wood, scrap metal, and sewer pipes. Some incorporate battery-powered heaters or small engines to replicate thermal signatures, making them look real to drone surveillance. The economics of this approach are extraordinary. Individual decoys cost less than $1,000 to produce. Russian UAVs expended in destroying them are valued at up to $50,000 per unit. That is a cost exchange ratio of at least 50 to 1 in Ukraine's favor. When you consider that at scale, the decoy program is not just a tactical trick, it is an economic warfare instrument. Reported crew efficiency rates for the actual M777 range from 80 to 95% of fired rounds striking intended targets, with a maximum barrel life of approximately 2,500 rounds before replacement. The M777 adaptation story illustrates a broader principle relevant across the conflict. Western-designed platforms are being significantly modified in the field to survive a drone-saturated environment their original designers did not anticipate. This suggests the limiting factor on Ukrainian artillery effectiveness is no longer the platform itself. It is supply chain continuity, a point reinforced by the Institute for the Study of War's warning, cited through the 24 War and Politics channel, that any easing of sanctions on Russia combined with slower Patriot interceptor deliveries would significantly increase the scale and intensity of Russian missile strikes on Ukraine. On the question of supply chain continuity, and specifically the question of how Western components continue to reach Russian weapons, documents obtained by the Financial Times from the Office of the President of Ukraine, cited by the 24 War and Politics channel, identified microchips from U.S. companies Texas Instruments, AMD, and Kyocera AVX, as well as components from German, Dutch, and other manufacturers, inside a potassium hydride 101. Some of those components carry serial numbers indicating production in 2024 and 2025, after sanctions were introduced. Ukraine's Presidential Sanctions Commissioner Vladislav Vashchuk stated that potassium hydride 101 cruise missiles used in the May 14th strike were produced in Russia in the second quarter of 2026, meaning they were not drawn from pre-existing stockpiles.
This is a critical distinction.
The Institute for the Study of War, per the same channel, noted that Russia is launching missiles on an assembly line basis, with no large stockpiles being accumulated. Debris from a January strike separately included parts of Chinese and Taiwanese origin, per the Financial Times. The Institute for the Study of War also reported indications that U.S. efforts to block artificial intelligence-related component supply may have had some effect. Specifically, there are signs that targeted controls limited Russia's use of AI in Shahed-type drones. This creates a direct policy tension that policymakers in Washington and Brussels must navigate. Western components are still reaching Russian weapons producers despite broad sanctions, while narrowly targeted component controls are simultaneously showing some effectiveness in specific subsystems. The European Council's €28.3 billion tranche earmarked for Ukraine's defense industry from the €90 billion loan represents one structural response to that asymmetry. The Trump-Xi summit in Beijing, held approximately 2 days before the Strat News global broadcast, produced what analysts Manoj Kewal Ramani and Brigadier Anil Rahman of the Takshashila Institution characterized as modest substantive gains for the United States against a backdrop of structural Chinese advantage. Kewal Ramani assessed that Washington's operative objective was not to secure specific concessions but rather to establish a floor on the bilateral relationship, a modus vivendi for the duration of the Trump administration.
In that limited sense, the summit achieved its goal. But the framing of the relationship itself was set by Beijing. Xi Jinping articulated what he called constructive strategic stability, presenting the relationship as one between a rising power, China, and an established hegemon in transition, the United States, with the onus of compliance implicitly placed on Washington. Trump's post-summit characterization on the platform X described a strong relationship and referenced a so-called G2 formulation, per Rahman's account. The concrete outcomes, as reported by Rahman, were as follows. China offered assurances on Iran and the Strait of Hormuz situation. Beijing committed to purchasing approximately 200 aircraft against an initial U.S. request for 500. The United States made concessions on chips. There were assurances on beef purchases calibrated around the timing of the delegation's arrival. Trump stated publicly that Chinese oil tankers would come to Texas and Louisiana to purchase U.S. oil. A Board of Trade and a Board of Investment were to be established, focused on what U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Morrison described as non-strategic trade and non-strategic investment domains. Kewal Ramani cautioned strongly against taking purchase commitments at face value. He pointed to the Phase 1 trade deal of 2020 as the relevant precedent. By 2021, China had underperformed its purchase commitments by approximately 40% overall, and by approximately 18-19% on agricultural products specifically. China's share of U.S. agricultural imports had declined from approximately 18-19% to approximately 12-13% of China's overall imports since that period. The pattern of commitment followed by underperformance is established. On Taiwan, the asymmetry in the post-summit statements is stark. The Chinese post-summit statement described Taiwan as the most important issue in China-U.S. relations, quoting Xi as warning that mishandling it would lead to, and this is a direct quote, a dangerous situation, clashes, and conflict. The U.S. post-summit statement contained no mention of Taiwan. Trump separately stated he is not seeking Taiwan independence and does not want to, as he put it, travel 9,500 miles to fight a war. The fate of a long-delayed $40 billion U.S. arms package for Taiwan, previously approved by Congress, remains unresolved, with Trump telling Fox News he could approve it or choose not to. For India, Kewal Ramani assessed that managed U.S.-China competition is the most favorable outcome from New Delhi's perspective, preferable to either a formal G2 arrangement between Washington and Beijing or open conflict. Rahman expressed concern that China had emerged from the summit in a stronger and more influential position, describing the United States as the primary provider of strategic stability within the existing international system, and questioning whether that stability is being reliably maintained. One piece of sequencing underscores China's centrality to multiple strategic calculations simultaneously. Putin is scheduled to visit Beijing on May 19th and 20th, per Russian state media, according to the 24 War and Politics channel. That visit follows directly on the heels of the Trump-Xi summit, positioning Beijing as the essential interlocutor for both the Western and Russian strategic blocs at the same moment. Adrian Karatnitsky's assessment adds a useful layer here. He told the 24 War and Politics channel that China prefers a slow burn in Ukraine without a Russian victory, because that situation keeps Russia dependent on Beijing and prevents Russia from emerging as a strategic problem for China. That framing is consistent with Kiwal Ramani's analysis. Beijing is protecting its own interests, not sharing global responsibility with Washington. Now to Europe's trade positioning, which is the third major pillar of today's briefing, and perhaps the one with the longest structural consequences. EU Trade Commissioner Maros Sefcovic, speaking to The Economist's Inside Geopolitics program from Brussels, presented the most detailed official European account of where the EU currently stands on trade. The picture he described is one of structural dependency and acute pressure from two directions simultaneously. On China, the EU-China trade deficit is running at approximately 1 billion euros per day. Over the past 5 years, Chinese exports to the EU have increased by approximately 50%, while EU exports to China have decreased by approximately 30%. Sefcovic characterized this trajectory as, in his words, simply unsustainable. EU dependence on China for critical minerals exceeds 90% across multiple categories, a figure that, when you hear it stated plainly, explains why the structural response has been as dramatic as it has. On the United States, the EU-US trade relationship involves 1.7 trillion euros in annual trade and approximately 5 trillion euros in mutual investment, a framework reached at what Sefcovic called the Turbary talks in Scotland, applied a 15% all-inclusive tariff on EU goods, including retroactively. He referenced a memorandum of understanding signed with U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on critical minerals and a subsequent action plan discussed with U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer. He said the EU would examine the agreement with a magnifying glass. The stakes are clear. Approximately half of EU GDP and more than 30 million jobs are dependent on or linked to global trade. The structural response to both the China dependency and the U.S. tariff environment is the Pax Silica initiative, described in detail by Visualpolitik EN. Launched by the United States in December 2025, Pax Silica initially enrolled 6 countries, Australia, Israel, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and the United Kingdom, with subsequent additions including the Philippines, Finland, Sweden, the UAE, and India. The initiative is framed as a technology supply chain that bypasses China, described informally as a technological NATO. To understand the scale of what Pax Silica is attempting to address, consider the data on Chinese dominance that Visualpolitik EN's cited reporting presents. Beijing controls nearly 90% of global rare earth refining. It refines 65% of lithium, 75% of graphite, and 68% of cobalt. In 2024, China produced over 1 billion tons of steel, more than half of global production. It dominates more than 80% of every stage of the solar energy production chain. It controls between 60 and 100% of each key link in the battery supply chain, per the International Energy Agency. And China accounts for nearly 60% of the world's tonnage of new ships leaving shipyards annually. That concentration is the strategic problem Pax Silica is designed to solve over the medium to long term. And the most operationally specific element of the initiative involves the Philippines. The Golden Hub Project in New Clark City, Tarlac, an AI industrial zone spanning approximately 4,000 acres, or roughly 1,600 hectares, is to be administered as a special economic zone under U.S. common law with diplomatic immunity protections. Visualpolitik EN described this as the first agreement of its kind globally. The Philippines is the world's second largest producer and largest exporter of nickel ore, with 1 in 4 tons of globally exported nickel ore originating there. Philippine semiconductor and electronics exports reached approximately $46 billion in 2022, with projections suggesting exports may reach $50 billion in the current period. A complementary instrument, Project Vault, established in February 2026, constitutes a U.S. stockpile of critical minerals valued at nearly $12 billion. Corporate investment is accelerating in parallel. Google announced a $15 billion data center investment in southeastern India in October 2025. Microsoft committed $17.5 billion to cloud and AI infrastructure in India in December 2025, described as its largest investment in Asia to date. South Korea's KOSPI index recorded approximately 76% gains in 2026, attributed by Visualpolitik EN to an AI rally, with Samsung and SK Hynix warning that AI-driven memory shortages could persist until 2027 and beyond due to high bandwidth memory demand. From the EU side, Sefcovic acknowledged the parallel realignment, citing recently concluded or advanced trade agreements with Mercosur, India, Indonesia, Australia, and Latin American partners. He also noted EU participation as an invited partner in the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, a bloc representing approximately 30% of global GDP and 40% of trade. Building on all of this, the picture that emerges is of a Western-aligned trade architecture being constructed in real time, with the Philippines as its most concrete operational node, India as its largest investment destination, and the EU as a structurally engaged but not fully integrated participant, still managing its own parallel relationships with both Washington and Beijing. Beyond the battlefield and the trade tables, Russia is pursuing a different kind of campaign, one conducted at film festivals and arts biennales. Irish journalist Kellen Robertson, reporting for Channel 24 from Venice, documented Russia's return to the Venice Biennale for the first time since 2022, with the Russian pavilion reopening during the event's pre-opening week, running approximately from the 6th to the 9th of the month. Early reports had suggested approximately 30 members in the Russian delegation. What Robertson found was different in character. Top echelon Russian society figures, individuals he identified as directly connected to the Kremlin, and oligarchs sanctioned by EU member states. Robertson said he used dossiers and reverse image searches, including a tool he identified as PIMR, to identify attendees. Nearly every individual he observed matched entries in those dossiers. Some travelers used dual passports, including Turkish passports, to circumvent sanctions. Robertson alleged that individuals associated with the Biennale lobbied Italian authorities to have sanctions waived for the event's specific dates. He said Russia contributed approximately 2 million euros to the Venice Biennale per multiple individuals he spoke with on the ground, and alleged that a figure he identified as Mikkelsen, described as a Russian billionaire, is channeling money through renovations into the arts festival. The Russian pavilion, Robertson said, offered free drinks on an open terrace, and he estimated thousands of visitors passed through during the pre-opening period alone. He characterized it as a state media operation. Most Russian-produced coverage was broadcast on Russian state television channels using, in his description, Russia's most prominent journalists. Robertson placed the Biennale episode within a broader pattern he described as encompassing the Oscars, the Olympics, Cannes, opera houses, and music festivals, noting that Russia returned to major cultural events following its 2014 Crimea annexation, including at Cannes by 2017 and the G7 by 2018. The implication is that the current re-engagement follows a documented playbook. This connects directly to a separate European Broadcasting Union controversy reported by the 24 War and Politics channel. Eurovision executive director Martin Green stated that Russia's return to the contest is theoretically possible if Russian broadcasters ceased acting as a Kremlin mouthpiece, and that one country invading another is not in itself an automatic reason for EBU exclusion. The remarks prompted criticism in the UK Parliament, with Liberal Democrat MP Tom Gordon describing them as, in his words, an astonishing admission and moral cowardice. Labour MP Josh Newbery also criticized Green's position.
Two final developments round out the picture of Russia's strategic posture. First, Moldova. Vladimir Putin signed a decree simplifying the process for residents of Transnistria, the unrecognized Russian-backed territory on the left bank of Moldova's Dniestru River, to obtain Russian citizenship. The decree removed the requirements for 5 years of residence in Russia, demonstrated knowledge of Russian language, history, and law. Applications can now be submitted through Russian diplomatic missions. The territory, home to approximately 470,000 people, has hosted Russian troops since it declared independence from Moldova in 1990, without recognition from any United Nations member state. Russian Security Council Secretary Sergei Shoigu claimed in April that more than 220,000 Russian citizens live in Transnistria and stated their security is allegedly under threat. Language Karetnitsky, speaking to the 24 War and Politics channel, characterized as directly analogous to the rhetorical framing used before the 2022 Ukraine invasion. The citizenship simplification decree fits a documented pattern of using passport issuance and citizenship claims as precursors to justifying future intervention. Second, on the broader negotiation environment. Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico stated, per the 24 War and Politics channel, that effective European communication with the Kremlin requires understanding the Russian soul, and claimed that European leaders who publicly distance themselves from Moscow privately seek information about Kremlin positions. Fico also referenced Putin having mentioned former German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder as a potential communicator with Russia. Scott Lucas of University College Dublin's Clinton Institute told the same channel that European officials oppose the Schroeder proposal. Der Spiegel reported that some European officials view former Chancellor Angela Merkel as more credible, citing her contacts with both Putin and Zelensky. The EU's response was to name Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas as its representative for any communication channel. Karetnitsky assessed that Putin's public statement that the war is nearing its end represents a genuine signal rather than posturing, citing Russia's lack of battlefield progress, economic deterioration, and what he described as Putin's declining ability to manipulate the Trump administration, which is now preoccupied with Iran. He said he believes Putin is readying the Russian public for a real arrangement, while also noting that Russia could be seeking to induce Ukraine to lower its guard. Gherkin's April 28 Telegram post, per the military show, characterized the situation in his characteristic starkness. The war for compromise has not only reached a dead end, it has ended in failure. The enemy is fighting to win, we are fighting to compromise, and now compromise is becoming extremely difficult. That sentence, from a man in a Russian prison, relayed through his wife's Telegram account, citing a 90 billion euro European loan as the turning point, may be the most compressed summary of where this war stands today. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing from Briefing Desk for Monday, May 18, 2026. From Ukraine's skies to Beijing's summit rooms, to the halls of the Venice Biennale, the contours of a long war and a shifting world order are coming into sharper focus. We'll be back tomorrow with the next briefing.